The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Chuck Slaughter, founder and CEO of Living Goods, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
When people want to find an organization that has taken the best practices from business and successfully applied them to the nonprofit sector, Living Goods should be the place to start. And in this case, the business model they have created is getting urgently needed health care and medical supplies to people in the developing world who otherwise would lack access to them. It's a wonderful story. And here to share it with us is Chuck Slaughter, the founder of Living Goods. Good evening, Chuck, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Give us a snapshot of what Living Goods does and the mission of the organization.
Well, our mission, Denver, is really simple. Our mission is to save kids' lives, but we take an unusual approach to it. What Living Goods does is we support networks of community health workers throughout Africa. And these are women who are digitally empowered. We give them a smartphone and they go door to door. They help teach their friends and neighbors and family how to improve their health. And then they make a living by selling high impact, low cost health products. But what's really transformed this model in the last several years is technology. When we started, we kind of described what we do as sort of the Avon of community health, bringing the power of a simple business model to the imperative to improve healthcare in the developing world. In the last 3 or 4 years, it's really become more like the Uber of healthcare, putting the power really in the hands of the consumers and enabling them to call for the healthcare they need any time of day and have a local independent healthcare provider come to them, provide them an accurate diagnosis using an algorithm on their phone, and sell them the medicine they need right there on the spot.
Unbelievably interesting. Well, you came from the private sector. You built a company from scratch. It became a $100 million company called TravelSmith, and you sold that around 2004. How did you get from there, Chuck, to coming up with this idea of what would ultimately become Living Goods?
So there actually was sort of an aha moment. I'll share a funny part of it. It starts accidentally, as many big changes in life do.
For sure.
With a beer. I was having a beer at a party in San Francisco with a friend of mine who had also recently sold a business. And he had been supporting a little healthcare endeavor in East Africa. And I think at some point I must have made the mistake of telling him that I was thinking about the next thing I wanted to do. And I had worked in the social sector when I was younger, just out of college. And I've always just, I think since then, been captivated by the idea, been animated by the idea of how can we use the tools of business to help solve big, complicated, important social problems. And my friend Dan, who has, by the way, I have to say, the best email address that I know of. His name is Dan German, and his email address is dangerman at gmail.com. Shout out to Dan, because Dan really changed my life. He got me involved in a healthcare program in East Africa. And that program was using the franchise business model to support expansion of access to basic medicines in Kenya. And my wife and I gave them some money. Dan asked me to join the board, which I did. And I went over to see this. And I was really just immediately entranced by this idea. And yet, one of the things I saw was that many of these stores, these franchised medical clinics, were not doing so well. They were losing money. And what we also noticed was that they had a lot of slack time during the day. There were periods when a lot of people coming and a lot of periods when it was very quiet. And the local manager and I came up with the idea of getting people out of their little stores where they were twiddling their thumbs and out into the community and going door to door and going into schools and churches and such. This worked fabulously.
Wow.
Turned many of the stores from losing money to making money. And it made them more proactive and more in, you know, what you like to think of as the health care business rather than just the sick care business. And I found myself ruminating on this and I thought, well, if going out door to door is so much more successful than waiting for people to come to you, you know, what if you took that to its logical extreme and got rid of the storefront and just went door to door? And I'm like, hold the phone. I'm not the first person to think of this crazy idea.
No, I think 1886 is when the first person was.
Exactly. You think of companies like Avon, which started here in the 19th century, and Tupperware and Amway and so forth. And I went and did my homework. And as part of that homework, I actually went and became an Avon lady.
Were you a good Avon lady?
Okay. You know, look, I don't think I broke any sales records, but I did learn a lot of things.
I bet.
And there are lessons that I took directly from that experience that ended up informing the original concept for Living Goods.
Well, that's a great metaphor because I think that really brings it home, and I understand exactly what you're doing. Now, you mentioned access to health care. There are about 7.5 billion people in the world right now.
Yeah.
How many of them don't have access to basic health care?
Well, it's interesting. Two-part answer to that question. So well over 2 billion people lack access to adequate health care. And upstream from that problem is we have, depending on who's counting, you know, a shortage of anywhere from 2 to 7 million healthcare workers in order to fill that need,
Which is projected to go much higher.
It's going to continue to grow, and you know, how does this manifest itself? You know, throughout the world, there are still, despite all the advances we know of, 6 million children who are dying every year for want of the simplest healthcare interventions that cost less than a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about these healthcare workers or these community health promoters, as you call them. I know most of them are women, but tell us a little bit about them. I mean, what kind of people you're looking for?
Yeah.
How do you hire them? How do you train them?
Yeah. So, you know, taking the cue from the sort of the direct selling model, what the whole sort of community health worker idea and the Amway Avon idea have in common is that who do you trust most? Your friends, your neighbors, the people who are most closely connected to you socially. That's the power of the Avon model. It's original social network business.
You're right.
And it's actually probably became profitable a lot earlier than a lot of them that we think of today. So these are women who we recruit are high school educated, usually no more than a high school or even a grade school education, who live in the communities that they serve. And it is 98% women.
Yep.
They tend to be in their 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Okay.
And these are women who both who we give the opportunity and who seek the opportunity both to make a difference and to make a living at the same time. And that's what this enables them to do. They're recruited very carefully through a process of referrals, applications, role playing, math tests, numeracy tests, and so forth.
Yeah, you only hire about 20% of the applicants, so it's a pretty rigorous process.
In some cases, even fewer. There are cases we'll have 20 or 30 applicants for 2 or 3 slots.
Well, each of them is then giving a Living Goods health toolkit in a bag. So what's in that bag, and what do they focus on when they go and visit a potential customer?
Yeah. So you can think about the bag in two different sets of tools. So one is the what sort of products and services that they can provide.
Mm-hmm.
So in the places we work, 60 or 70% of the preventable deaths come from very simple things like malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia, complications in post-birth. And so the areas we focus on from a health point of view are those three big killer diseases, pregnancy, family planning, nutrition, immunization. Those areas. And what are the products they have to address those? They have the medicines for malaria, for pneumonia, for diarrhea. They have a blood test they can do for malaria. They have family planning products. They have basic household hygiene products like soap and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they can also provide what we call home health tools like water filters, high-efficiency cook stoves that reduce the amount of smoke in the household. Solar lights. And then importantly and increasingly, we're really in this nutrition space because nutrition is so important in childhood development. So they sell a line of fortified foods that help kids grow healthy and strong and do better in school.
Like porridge.
Yes. We have Living Goods Healthy Start Porridge.
Speak a little bit more about this smart health app because it's so interesting. What are the capabilities of that app?
So you asked about the tools and their toolkit. This has become the most important tool.
Yeah.
So every Living Goods health worker, and I should add, these are not just Living Goods health workers. Every health worker we support is actually a government-authorized health worker. So we're really working to strengthen and support the government community health
And if I'm right
platform.
About this, they don't work for you. They're entrepreneurs, correct?
That's right. They're independent entrepreneurs. They're not on our payroll.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually not on the government's payroll, but they serve the government's community health strategy. This smart health app that we've created sits on an Android phone. We provide every health worker with an Android device. And it does several very, very powerful things. One is It has an automated diagnosis algorithm that allows them to accurately and consistently diagnose malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia every time, to accurately and consistently triage pregnancies, have an informed, structured conversation about family planning and such. And so this enables us to ensure the quality of diagnosis that's being done in the village level in these far-flung places. But also importantly, and what really in a way is our secret sauce, is it's a performance management system. It enables Living Good's field managers, their supervisors, government ministers, and even our funders to see the performance, to see every single transaction between that health worker and her customer in real time. So every childhood's assessed, every pregnancy visit, every postnatal follow-up, we get the name, the telephone number, a GPS location, and a timestamp. And that, one, enables us to audit that everything that we're saying we're delivering is actually being delivered. Mm-hmm. Funders can see that. And that can be, in turn, can be checked very quickly and efficiently. So instead of having to go out later and double-check these things on foot, that data can be almost immediately verified through a text or a phone call by an independent source. But the performance management aspect is really a game changer. You can imagine this community health idea is very hard to manage. Mm-hmm. People are independent. They're out in the field. You know, they can't punch a time clock. The supervisor can't be with them. So how do you manage their performance? And this system enables their managers to see everything they do in real time. And here's where it gets really cool. We now put a tool in the hands of the managers that allows them to use the data that's coming back from their health workers to see who needs help on any given day.
Oh, great. That's robust feedback.
Yeah, but it's fast. It allows them to prioritize their time.
Instantaneously, yeah.
Here are health workers. Here are maybe, you know, five who are struggling because they're not registering enough pregnancies. You can see that in real time. Get out into the field or call them. And it just speeds that whole performance management process. It used to take a cycle time of 6 to 8 weeks for information to get from the field, you know, get collected on paper, tabulated, put in spreadsheets, send to an office, and then sent back. That feedback loop is now instantaneous.
Has that performance management mindset permeated the entire organization right to your headquarters in San Francisco? I mean, would that be a way to define your culture?
We've always had that. That predates the digital.
Mm-hmm.
We've always, you know, been a performance-centered, performance-focused organization. Every health worker, every manager has had specific weekly targets, and we've always tracked those. And by the way, the other thing that just distinguishes how we work is that everyone in the organization is paid for performance. So those frontline health workers are paid for performance in two ways. One is they can earn a margin on the sale of some of those products.
Mm-hmm.
But two, and increasingly importantly, we can pay them incentives based on the specific tasks that they're delivering on every single day.
Yeah.
So there are health outcomes we need to do that have nothing to do with a product, like registering a pregnancy or following up with an acutely ill child. And we can pay them specific bonus for each one of those that they do.
Let me ask you one more question in this regard, and that has to do with inventory. So many public health systems that I've looked at, they're always running out of stock of essential medicines. How does Living Goods address that challenge?
I have to say, this always befuddles me. I'll tell you why. I started this company, TravelSmith. TravelSmith's a direct mail catalog. We mailed, at the peak, probably 4 or 5 million catalogs a month. We held 15,000 stock keeping units. And the number one customer satisfaction issue is, are you in stock?
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, our lead times were months and months. Mm. And we managed to have a very high in-stock rate with that level of complexity, 15,000 units. In these community health systems, we're talking about 25 or 30 items you have to keep in stock. And the lead times really, these things have long shelf life. The lead times are not that long.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be that hard. And in fact, it isn't in our view. We maintain our own system of branches and warehouses. We have, between us and our partners in the region, we have over 100 of these throughout East Africa. And we make sure that those outlets are in stock 100% of the time. And we have, of course, we have a digital system for that as well, so that we can see the inventory also in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know days, weeks ahead of time if stocks are running low.
You believe, Chuck, that evidence of impact for a nonprofit organization is almost akin to what profit is for a business. Share with us a little bit about your thinking on that, and what have you done to create that kind of evidence that shows that these interventions are really working and making a difference?
Yeah. Well, as many of your listeners will know, the gold standard for proving the impact of a social intervention is a randomized control trial.
Mm-hmm.
And we did something that was a bit controversial at the time, which was we committed to doing one of these randomized studies from literally from day one. And I'll tell you why. Very, very personal. I do this pro bono, and I wanted to make sure, I wanted to be certain that I wasn't wasting my own time.
Yeah.
And I knew very little about this kind of research when I started, but I quickly learned that this was the best way, not necessarily the cheapest, but the best way to know for sure if you are having an impact. And so we invested in this in one of these randomized studies. Great support from one of our big early funders, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been with us for over 10 years. We were hoping, Denver, that this would show a 10 to 12% reduction in all-cause child mortality. We got the results from this study a few years ago. This was done across 214 villages, 8,000 households.
It's a good study.
It was done by some of the best teams in the business from the Poverty Action Lab.
Dean Carlin's been on the show.
That's right. They did the data collection, and we worked for Innovations for Poverty Act, the Innovations for Poverty Action. The result really floored us, and we exceeded the target by almost twofold. The study showed that we were reducing child mortality by over 25%, and there were subsets of areas that we saw reductions of 30 and 40% in some geographic areas. And not only that, we saw things like a significant reduction in stunting.
Hmm.
And one of the most surprising unplanned effects, they surveyed independent non-living goods providers, again, comparing where we worked to some of these control sites. And they saw the people who were competing, quote unquote, competing with us, that their prices were as much as 17% lower than in the control sites. And then just as importantly, if not more so, the prevalence of counterfeits, which is a big problem in these African markets. Counterfeits can be up to 30 or 40% of what you find in these private, poorly regulated outlets. The prevalence of counterfeits in competing outlets dropped by 50%.
Wow. So the unforeseen benefits of this was astounding.
You usually think about, the unintended consequences being negative.
That's
in this
right.
case, it was unintended consequences.
A nice
they were quite positive.
And I know this was not inexpensive. It was about $750,000. But I can only imagine that has probably paid itself over many times as you shared this information with the donor community.
Yeah. This was probably the most transformative investment and activity that we've engaged in. It has... Obviously, it was very persuasive with funders. Just as importantly, it was very persuasive with local policymakers who were critical to our journey, and very persuasive with partners who we work with and who we seek to work with to replicate this model. That's a core element of our philosophies and our strategies. We're not engaging in this work just to build living goods. We're really trying to invent a better way for people to get to access their health care. And our measured success is not how many people we serve directly. It's how much we're moving. We're changing the overall landscape of community health. And so being able to persuade other implementers, policymakers, private funders, and importantly, these institutional funders like USAID and the Global Fund, that kind of research has been indispensable. We're actually doing a second RCT now.
Yeah. What I found it to be interesting about that too, Chuck, was that you took a pause about a year in on this study.
Yes.
And you tweaked it a little bit. And you also looked at your operations.
Yes.
And see where they could be strengthened. And that really gets me to this. Mm. You're a learning organization, and you're a very fast learning organization. Mm. And that is so much easier said than done. What are some of the keys to learning fast the way you do at Living Goods?
Wow. It's a very powerful piece of how we work and how we think. And we're fortunate to have funders who get that.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with thinking about how do we want to finance this? And so we're funded in an unusual way. The majority of our funding comes from successful entrepreneurs who have become successful philanthropists. These are people like Chris Hone of the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, Jeff Skoll, Richard Branson.
Good group of people.
Very lucky. But we sought like-minded funders who saw the power of using the tools from the private sector, but who also were willing to provide a core unrestricted funding. Mm. And so having unrestricted funding allows us to try things and to walk away from things that aren't working. So that kind of funding flexibility is a key piece of it. Behind that is a willingness, of course, to stop doing things quickly that don't seem to be working. That's a problem. That's a problem in all the sectors. It's a particular problem in the social sector.
Sure is. Yeah.
We try to break down big ideas into small pieces and test those quickly and cheaply. But the mantra I always think about, Denver, is what are the ideas that we can generate that have the potential for really enormous, large impact or large improvements in sustainability, but that we can test quickly?
Yeah, yeah.
That's where the big payoff comes.
Sticking with the idea of funding and also the concept of performance and results, you're teasing out this proposition which will actually lower donors' risk when they help support living goods. Tell us what you're thinking about there.
Well, if I can step back for a second, I think a big challenge in financing global public health, of course, right now, is that the total, you know, envelope of funding for public health is flat or declining. You take into account inflation, what's happening in the UK and in the US and some of the other key funders. It's a challenging environment. The needs are not decreasing, but the financing available is tight.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is that one of the reasons for that is, let's face it, there's a big chunk of taxpayers out there who don't feel like they're getting their money's worth when they're investing in any kind of government programs, you know, domestic, let alone foreign aid. And we've had funders, public and private, for years have had it, to oversimplify it, a funding model, which is, you know, pay for inputs up front and pray that you get outcomes out back. And we think there's an opportunity now that there's increasing interest in to bring in a new sort of financing approach where you provide an opportunity to funders to pay for results rather than just to pay for inputs. And if you have the power of an RCT like we do and proven results, that's not so risky for us, but it's a significant risk reduction for the funders. So my hope is by not just Living Goods, but other actors, and not just in healthcare, but education, using these pay for results sort of schemes will reduce risks for funders. And if the philanthropic markets work anything like the capital markets, which they do to some extent, reducing risk should attract more capital. And so literally what are we talking about here is a mechanism that would allow any funder, private foundation, individual, USAID, to buy results basically from Living Goods, to buy the number of pregnancies we can deliver in a facility, the number of children that get treated for malaria, the number of women who we convert to a modern family planning method, and pay us a bonus or a piece rate for each of those things that we deliver. And again, going back to your question about technology, technology is a powerful enabler of this pay for results idea. It's an idea that's been around for a while, but it's struggled in partly because the cost of verifying results is prohibitive if you have to do it on foot.
Yeah, that's right.
And with the technology that I described before, where we capture the name and phone number and GPS of every contact, those results can now be verified with a text or a phone call. And so reducing the cost of verification enables this pay-for-performance kind of financing.
That is a game changer, and you're absolutely right. I think with social impact bonds and other things, sometimes the intermediaries and did it work and did it not, it's a little bit hazy. But when you get it like this, it's pretty clear cut. You don't need anybody to – you don't have to go to Instant Replay to decide whether the ball was caught or not. It's right there for everybody to see.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about collaborations, Chuck. But before we get to some of the NGOs
– should I add one other thing about
that? Sure.
Which is that we're very lucky that we have a visionary funder here in New York, actually, the Deerfield Foundation, who are serving as the sort of pilot outcome payer for this pay-for-results mechanism that we're creating. And so our goal right now is to figure out how to syndicate this to other – you know, we want to do is to syndicate it to a whole range of different kinds of funders, private and public. But Deerfield is sort of paying for the design and construction of this thing that other funders will be able to leverage.
We will stay tuned on that.
Yeah.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
As for collaborations, let us start with a place that I think a lot of people don't start, and that's government. We sometimes overlook government, and I know the success of these ventures are so dependent upon having a government creating the ecosystem that allows organizations such as yours to be successful. Tell us a little bit about your partnerships you've had with governments over in Africa.
Yeah. I'll start by saying those of you who may know anything about Living Goods will know, when I started this, government, I really thought of government as the problem, not the solution, which I think is true to some extent. But let's face it, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, if philanthropists in New York are still paying for healthcare for our customers in Kenya and Uganda and Zambia, we will not have succeeded. That can't be the end game here. You know, the end game has to be a vibrant, locally owned, locally financed community health system.
Correct.
And so the if you have that end game in mind, the question you have to obsess about is how do you – what has to be done between where you are today to get there? And so start with this. Every health worker we support is by definition a government health worker. And our increasingly the way we see our job is helping the government strengthen its system for selecting, training, and as we discussed earlier, doing the performance management for these healthcare workers. The technology – the mobile technology we described is a key enabler for that.
Mm-hmm.
It enables us. The technology has a lot of the business intelligence, if you will, built in to the app.
Yep.
So it's a way of transferring that knowledge, transferring the model, if you will, more seamlessly to government as the owner. Now, but the other big question, though, is how eventually do you get the governments to finance this? And again, this is a place where I think this pay-for-results approach could potentially be transformative. The governments can go to their own traditional funders, like, you know, but bilateral agencies, and say, look, you've been reluctant to invest with us to do community health before. What if we can give you a pay-for-results mechanism so that you're only paying for what you get? It's another way we are seeing that we can, you know, if you will, you know, lay the groundwork, the path that enables governments to become the ultimate both managers and funders of this.
Significant in so many different levels. I mean, I was stunned to see that, you know, it's like 1% of our government programs in this country have any evidence behind them. It is stunningly low, and it's something that we urgently need.
Yeah.
The other thing about social entrepreneurs, I'll say, I've had so many people on the show who said when they started out, they wanted nothing to do with government.
Yes.
But then realize that if you're ever going to have impact at scale, you have to include them. You just can't do it. Yeah. They have too many of the levers of power, whether they give money or not. They're too critical to the process.
Well, I'll share another really interesting aspect of working with government in this day and age in sectors like healthcare and education. The other power of this technology, when you think about it, is that it's enabling these low-skilled, you know, high school-educated women to do relatively sophisticated healthcare work.
Mm-hmm.
With the aid of this kind of technology, we are now have gotten permission and authority from these governments to enable these high school-educated women to diagnose and treat pneumonia. You know, in any other markets, you'd need a minimum of 4 years of, you know, postgraduate education to do that, to be able to provide those kind of services. The technology provides a way to train people much faster and to ensure the consistency and accuracy the way they're doing these important medical procedures. It's a potential real game changer. In so many other sectors, you think about technology as potentially destroying jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a case where it's actually creating jobs.
No, that is so good to hear, because that's exactly. Yeah. We fret about how they're taking them away, and here it is. It's disruptive in such a positive sense. Getting to the NGOs, you have some great collaborations with the likes of BRAC, Population Services International, CARE, just to name a few.
Yeah.
But boy, you announced a big one at the World Economic Forum at Davos just recently with Last Mile Health.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, again, the context is we're an organization that believes passionately and from the get-go about the power and importance of partnerships. If you have the ambition really to transform a healthcare system, that's something that no one organization can ever conceive of doing on their own. I want to give a big shout out to our partners at BRAC.
Mm-hmm.
BRAC was our first and biggest partner. We've learned a tremendous amount from them. For your listeners who don't know them, you did a great show last week with their BRAC USA lead. They're one of the greatest NGOs in the world that nobody knows about.
For sure.
Terrific at scale and delivery. Started in Bangladesh in the 70s. They are now the largest NGO in Uganda, which is one of our biggest countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had the pleasure of working with them and learning from them over the years. But if we can't figure out ways to help other organizations to learn from what we do and in turn from us to learn from them, we won't get to the end state. So as part of that journey, this last year, we entered into a terrific partnership with Last Mile Health. This is a beautiful, very complementary arrangement. First of all, Raj and I have tremendous respect for other.
Now, Raj other. Would be whom?
Forgive me. So Raj Punjabi is the founder of Last Mile. I'm the founder of Living Goods. I'm a business guy, an MBA. Raj is an MD, practicing physician at Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, if we're gonna solve the healthcare problem, you know, it's gonna be from a combination of those skill sets.
Yep.
Last Mile, Raj is originally from Liberia. He built this organization to help fix the healthcare system there. They have a West Africa base, a West Africa. We're in East Africa. So it's very, very, very complementary.
Mm-hmm.
And we came together, but in part, and this is a great, you know, story for the philanthropists in your audience. We were in part brought together because we had a lot of common funders who saw the power of this potential collaboration. And over the course of last year, six of these major funders came to us together and committed $50 million to help us respectively scale up across the continent of Africa.
Impressive.
This idea of a digitally empowered community health worker. And technically, the big piece we're bringing to the partnership from our side is this smart health app. And Last Mile is creating a new platform called the Community Health Academy, which is going to put online a whole set of resources for community health policymakers and practitioners to help the dissemination of this approach. And I have to add, just on a personal note, I have tremendous personal respect for Raj, who I've known for years. As I mentioned to you earlier, I'm also a philanthropist hat. I'm a trustee of the Horace Goldsmith Foundation mm-hmm. here in New York, and in that role have advocated for and secured funding for Last Mile going back 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, well, just a great partnership. Yeah. Now, what do you hope to accomplish? Mm-hmm. Now, I know this $50 million is a challenge grant. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But what are the goals and objectives as you look to see what you're going to try to achieve in the next 4 years or so?
So our ambitions are big because the problem is big. 3 years ago, Living Goods was serving 1 million people, which was a lot by the measure. With the results from that RCT I described, we scaled up from 1 million fivefold to be serving over 5 million people. Also an impressive number, bigger than a lot of small countries you and I could name. But we don't want to stop there. And with this envelope of funding, it's providing the foundation to help us along our ambition plan in the next 4 years to go from serving 6 million people to serving 36 million people.
Wow.
And from supporting 6,000 to 7,000 health workers to supporting over 35,000 of these health workers across Africa. That's the goal. And the aim is to do it in just 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this $50 million challenge grant, you've secured yourself a wonderful partner that is helping you meet that grant. Tell us about them.
UBS.
Mm-hmm.
So UBS has been a great partner, collaborator for both Living Goods and Last Mile for a number of years. And they've made an extraordinary commitment to go out and help raise money from their high net worth client base and to match that themselves with money from their corporate foundation, which is called Optimus. This is terrific commitment. They're one of the only banks in the world I know who've offered to match their clients' philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
It really says something, I think, about them as an institution. But the power of this for anyone who's a UBS client is they're going to get a double match.
Yeah.
They're going to get a match from UBS, but they're also going to get a match from this network of funders who we've assembled. So you have a potential for getting at least 1.5 times your investment.
You know, you've probably never been involved in a collaboration of this order of magnitude. How do you think it changes everything as we begin to look at solving our social problems?
Well, this has come together literally just in the last 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've just been blown away to see is that the power of these philanthropists coming together has been really extraordinary. These are all big philanthropies and who do great things on their own. And let's face it, collaboration is hard.
Yeah, it
is. It has to be give and take. And yet just in these few short months, we've seen how the strength, the collective voice and the collective money, let's face it, of these philanthropists coming together has enabling us to take this ambition to a whole other level. It's bringing to the table actors who were not coming to the table before. Local governments, big multilateral institutions like the Global Alliance for Vaccines and the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria. Or all those things, you know, a sure thing? No.
Mm-hmm.
But the collective voice of the philanthropists and these organizations working together are being much more synergistic than have each of them done the same thing they were going to do on their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me close with this then. And I just want to take those numbers of serving 1 million, then 6 million or 5 million, and then 36 million.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about scaling. So many organizations have great programs, great interventions, but they do not know how to scale. What have you learned about scaling up an organization, and what have you learned about then institutionalizing that and making it part of the fabric?
I got to say one thing first. A lot of people complain about the things that don't scale. Let me just say about that is in the private sector, you know, 4 out of 5 startups don't make it.
Mm-hmm.
No, people don't tend to complain about that. Really, you got to break eggs if you want to make omelets. And it's okay that some things don't scale. So let me just, I had to get that off my chest.
I agree with you.
You know,
some things are just
not
meant to be what they're doing.
And if we don't invest in some things that don't work out, as philanthropists, I don't think we're doing our job. So failure is okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, as a philanthropist, it's okay if, I think a lot of philanthropists are too cautious. So it's okay if some of your things don't scale. But what are the big things I think that are behind our thinking around scale? One is, you know, I had the experience before this of rapidly growing a business. And so I knew what it takes to do this, first and foremost, from a people point of view. And so hiring ahead of the curve is a big secret to how we do this effectively. We're always hiring people who are, you know, 2 or 3 shoe sizes bigger than we think we need today.
It's where you want to go, not where you're at.
Yeah. And again, having flexible funding enables us to do that. Had we all restricted funding, you can't do that. So smart, flexible funding is a key to be able to hire the kind of capacity you need to do. Secondly, the kind of scale up that we're talking about now is going to be vastly easier, more effective, and less prone to risk because of the technology. We can see problems faster, address weaknesses faster, and avoid the kind of big problems that can come if your information cycles are analog. The other, you know, frankly, though, is also a willingness to pause. If you have a problem, and I've done that in my business life and in the social sector, you have to know when to take your foot off the gas when you're having a problem.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of organizations get into trouble, and that happened to me in my business. You know, we were tripling in size every year for our first 6 years. Tripling in size. And, you know, I remember my accounting teacher telling me, you don't put percents in the bank. There's a big difference between 300% growth when you're going from a million to 3 million, when you're trying to go from 100 million to 300 million.
Yeah.
And again, I learned that the hard way. You know, there's no better teacher than experience. But the other big piece about scaling that you brought up earlier really is thinking about the landscape, the government institutions, and the partners that you need to scale effectively. To me, that's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reminded of an admonition that my father often repeated that he didn't coin, but often shared, which is, you know, there's no limit to what you can accomplish when you make sure to give credit to the other guy.
Yeah.
And growing big, working with partners, hiring great talent, if you're not doing that, you're not going
to
get them.
Good words to end by. Well, Chuck Slaughter, the founder of Living Goods, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and how people can help if they're inclined to do so.
So you can find Living Goods at www.livinggoods.org. And as you can tell from this conversation, scaling in the way we want, achieving this great outcome of saving kids' lives is very much a team sport. We need money, yes. There's a great opportunity right now because of this matching opportunity from our core funders. If you're interested in engaging this kind of work, there's no better time from that mm-hmm. point of view. But more importantly, now to do the kind of scale we need partners and advocates. So people who, if you work in public health, if you work at institutions like USAID or the Global Fund, if you work in research, yours are the kind of voices and support and collaboration and insights we need to take this from a great idea to something that's institutionalized, that's durable, and that's going to be here for generations.
Well, thanks so much, Chuck, for a really interesting conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.